Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're having a very special conversation with a very thoughtful guy about our national security. He is Dakota Wood. He served with great distinction in the United States Marine Corps, rising to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He's now associated with the Heritage Foundation, where, among other good works, he has recently published, as its editor, the 2016 Index of U.S. Military Strength. Its subtitle is very important: Assessing America's Ability to Provide for the Common Defense. And Dakota, in the previous two segments, you've talked about the challenges to the common defense, and we've only lightly touched on some of them, I'm afraid, but we've nonetheless gotten a pretty compelling picture that this is a dangerous world and likely to become considerably more so as some of the adversaries that you've described are certainly going to be continuing to build up their offensive capabilities, conventional, nuclear, space, asymmetric, and the like. I'd like to talk with you about our capabilities. You've been studying this closely, of course, for your index, but also in your past incarnation and present. Start with the readiness of the forces we have. While he took a lot of crap for it, Don Rumsfeld famously said, you go to war with the army you have. How is that army and Air Force and Marine Corps and Navy shaping up today as you see it?
We think they're in a fairly marginal to weak status. When you look at what they're asked to do and you look at the individual service standards for what they determined to be combat ready, you know, could a force go out the door to accomplish a military task? Chief of Staff of the Army is on record saying that one-third of the Army meets that readiness capability. So that's one-third of the existing Army. Our assessment indicates that the existing Army we have is only two-thirds of the size that it needs to be. So you have an Army that is undersized to begin with, and within that undersized Army, only a third of that is ready to go. So just, back in 2012, they had 45 brigades, which was necessary to provide, you know, a supporting rotational base to handle just the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is not a near-peer competitor or anything like that, right? Just recently, they folded the flag on one of their latest brigades. They're now down to 31. So in the space of about 3.5 years, we've moved from 45 brigades down to 31 brigades, and only about 10 or 12 of those are actually at acceptable levels of readiness. So I think it's an indicator of the impact that the Budget Control Act has had, sequestration, you know, the reduced expenditure of funds investing in the nation's defense.
And I take it that similar kinds of conditions apply in the other services as well, maybe perhaps to a somewhat lesser degree, but that we are both undersized and inadequately ready.
You know, and readiness becomes ever more important the smaller the force gets. So if you don't have much to begin with, relative to a global power that truly has global interests, again, Cold War, we were up against a global competitor. That competitor, the Soviet Union, is no longer there. But the world remains the same size, and now we have a diverse array of competitors, China, Iran, North Korea, Russia. So you still need a global force. So the smaller that becomes, then it's more important for each one of those pieces to be that much more ready. And unfortunately, we have the reverse of that. So we've got a shrinking military. We need about 345 ships. We have 272. We need an army of 45 to 50 brigades. We have an army of 31 brigades. We had a Marine Corps of 27 battalions. They're now down to 23 and potentially shrinking further than that. It used to be that for the Air Force, a pilot to maintain combat proficiency would have to fly about 200 hours a year. In some squadrons, that's much reduced. And when you drop below 150 hours, the pilot is deemed non-combat deployable or capable. You wouldn't put them in a combat situation. And so the Secretary of the Air Force last spring, we'll see new testimony this spring, testified about reduced levels of readiness. Again, about a third of squadrons or thereabouts were actually up to combat levels of capability. So we're just in a fairly dire situation, which is odd given how much money we spend. But we're trying to maintain a world-class military force that is globally distributed against a globalized threat. And if you want people to be successful in the tasks you provide them and to come back home safely, they simply have to fly, drive, sail, and shoot rounds at ranges. And again, with the reduced funding, they're not able to do that. So each of the service chiefs are very concerned about the readiness of their shrinking force and the ability to prepare that force for future taskings.
This is troubling on so many different levels. For one thing, as you know, Dakota Wood, so well, we are still at war to some degree, and there's a lot of talk about being more so in the future, particularly among certain presidential campaigns. As you look at this, Dakota, are you struck by the fact that the condition of the United States military can only be further emboldening adversaries? And what you've already described is bad enough, but if they are convinced that we're actually dismantling such deterrent as we have to them, shouldn't we expect them to behave even more aggressively and badly elsewhere in the future?
Yeah, Frank, I mean, that is the heart of the matter. It truly is. It's not military power for military power. It's if we want a secure economy, if we want jobs, if we want, you know, economic vitality and cultural vitality, you have to be secure from other powers or interests that want to impose their view of life on their regions that affect, ripple back to affect the United States. So we want access to markets, be able to sell our goods and services, get access to raw material. And where powers like Russia and China and others expand their influence, it's reduced opportunity and reduced security for the United States. So when we take a kind of a submissive posture, when the perception is that we're weak, that we can't commit to something, that we're not there in strength and support of friends and allies, exactly as you said, it emboldens and encourages aggressive and provocative behaviors by our competitors who will move into those areas. So if you're Japan or the Philippines or Vietnam, where is the United States in trying to help push back? Because individually or even collectively, these are such small countries that can't do much against these big, larger powers. Germany's army, its total army, is only 60,000 strong. The Royal Navy of old only has about 17 surface combatants. So they have made bad choices over the last 20 or so years and are malpositioned to be able to stand up.
Dakota, let me ask you about this. You used a nice euphemism. Their view of life, I think, is the way you described what others may be trying to impose on us. It may actually be an end to our lives. And what I think it's so important, especially somebody with your military expertise and background, to bring home to the rest of us is when we have a military in this condition and we have enemies that are on the march, that does translate very likely into a loss of life, certainly of men and women in uniform, needlessly, and quite possibly a lot of the rest of us as well, doesn't it?
The Europeans are seeing this firsthand with the flood of migrants out of Syria and other countries, North Africa and Central Asia, into Europe, where in a Western ideal, you want to open your arms, invite people in, help them out, give them a better life. And what they didn't account for is dramatic differences in cultures, where people are coming from in terms of value systems, you know, their belief of what's right and wrong and appropriate, what is permissible. So if a young woman is walking down the street unaccompanied by a male, obviously, you know, she is a harlot and it's perfectly fine to attack her. I mean, these are the stories coming out of the capital cities and small towns of Europe. So my point is, you know, these cultural differences and different value systems and different way of living that stretch back centuries, if not 2,000 or 3,000 years, has to be accounted for in how we interact with the world. So, you know, we feel we're advanced. We've got a particular culture that's derived from a European basis and all that. But it's false to simply assume that the rest of the world operates that way. You know, Boko Haram in Africa, Islamic State in the Middle East. I mean, there are these other elements out there that are very aggressive and confident and very violent in imposing their will on others. And if we ignore that, we'll suffer the consequences.
Dakota Wood, we're going to talk about modernizing our military, the investments that are required for it, right after this.
go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.